I would like to welcome freelance writer Heather Shoemaker back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Heather.
Thanks so much. Great to be back, Aaron.
So, Heather, a couple of years ago you were here and you were talking about your book, Uncommon Conservation, The Story of Saving Grass River. And that really went with what you were doing as a writer at that time, mostly writing about environmental issues.
Yes, my background has been always writing and conservation, land conservation. So that book really was right up my alley, but all of a sudden I'm a parenting author.
That's so interesting. So life started to change, didn't it? You got married, you had some kids, you were no longer working at the South Pole.
Sorting garbage at the South Pole, yes.
Suddenly we're dealing with the reality of children. And at the end of that interview, I said to you, so what's next for Heather Shoemaker? And you said...
At the time, I was planning this book, and it was called Boxing at Preschool. And we talked about that.
Yes.
The original title was Boxing at Preschool, and through the process of selling the book, it has changed its name, and now it's called It's Okay Not to Share. But, you know, the boxing is still in there because a big section of the book has a celebration of roughhousing.
Yep.
And so the original ideas are still there, even though the title has changed.
So it's a big, beautiful book. It has such a nice feel to it. When I pulled it from the envelope, and it reminded me sort of like a cookbook. And the reason it reminded me of a cookbook is that you have 8 units in it.
Mm-hmm.
And each one is subdivided into various rules. And you could read this book from front to back, or if you had a particular problem with what was going on with a child or several children at that time, you could go to that chapter. That was
exactly
the intent.
That was the intent, because as a parent of young kids myself, I fully understand that no one has time to read a parenting book, especially when you need it the most, because your kids are challenging you and taking all your time. So when parents are turning towards a resource, I think it's only fair to give them a very readable book and one that they can go directly to a chapter in the middle and get the information they need. So if the child is having a lot of anger issues, or if the child is needing to roughhouse, or the child has whatever the issue is, you can go directly to that chapter and quickly get the information. And then when you forget what you read, because I always forget what I read, there's very handy little checklists and lists at the end of words to say, so you can go back as a reference and quickly remember if you've had a hard day. Oh, now what was that would be useful next time?
Which is really interesting, because you give the parent the appropriate behaviors they should apply and also the language
mm-hmm.
that they should use.
Yeah, it has specific suggested words that are very helpful.
So each of those chapters is broken down with a rule.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule might be something like, hang up a sign, no girls. Okay? If the guys want to play together, it's okay.
Right.
And we can go to any chapter and come up with one of those rules. And then you have the Renegade Reason.
Yes.
And the subtitle of the book is, well, the title of the book is, It's Okay Not to Share. And the subtitle is, And Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. So the Renegade Rule, what's that about?
Well,
the Renegade Reason.
I have to credit my editor at Tartar Penguin for this, because she's a mom herself of a very active 4-year-old boy. And when she heard about my book idea, she envisioned it instantly as a set of rules. Sort of rules for parenting, and in this case, renegade rules, because they're countercultural and counterintuitive and certainly not what you expect. So she wanted to change my fairly lengthy chapter ideas into a set of smaller digestible rules, and I was fine with that. She said, I want people to open the table of contents and see an amazing list hit them, like let your kids swear, let your kids hit and kick, and so that they raise eyebrows and get your attention. But then I wanted to make sure, I didn't mind if it was done that way, but I wanted to make sure that the logic and child development reasons behind these seemingly crazy rules would become clear right away. So we came up with a structure that would have the rule and then have the renegade reason behind it, so that you did immediately realize that I'm not completely off my rocker, but there's good science behind it.
And then it's followed by renegade blessings.
Yes. And that I would credit to Marty Link, a local author here.
A friend of both of ours.
A friend of both of ours, who's part of my writing group. And she said she liked The Renegade Rule, The Renegade Reason. She said, I feel as if you need to follow it with one more thing. And we came up with The Renegade Blessing based on her suggestion.
And then the Wyatt Works.
All kinds of parents are going to read this. Some people don't care so much about what the psychologists and the neuroscientists and all those good people have to say, and some won't believe me a word unless they read those studies in the original. So I wanted to satisfy both sets of parents. I wanted to make sure right away that they weren't just trusting me, that they were getting some information from well-respected and current thinkers in all our professions. So the Why It Works section explains what the psychologists and neuroscientists have to say on the subject to back this rule up.
So it's renegade but not wacko.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, people have said, when did renegade become common? When did common sense become renegade?
That's interesting. And another part of the chapter, which I really admire, was take off your adult lenses.
Yes, well, this is the most challenging because, of course, as adults, we don't think in the same way as children do. And when we see young children's behavior, let's say a child who wields a superhero cloak and says, bang, bang, we think, oh, that's violence. And we immediately think about what we heard on the news this morning and all the violence in the world. And we wish that the next generation could be spared all that and that we could just raise a generation of peaceful, loving people. And so we react as adults with this political view. And really what the kids' needs are and what their views are very different than ours. Sometimes, in this case, the child is slaying monsters. You may be the monster under the bed. Maybe they're worried about thunderstorms. Maybe, you know, whatever their issue is, they are fighting the bad guys and they're coming to save the day. They're learning morality in their play. But we jump to different conclusions because we are adults with a different worldview. So every chapter does have a reminder of how we see the world, and if you think about it from a child development perspective, how you could see it differently.
I know that my grandsons have the capacity to weaponize anything, especially sticks, and have long battles, but do no great damage
right.
to each other.
And they're probably giggling and having fun.
They're having a wonderful time.
So that's what we look for as the mark of behavior. If they're behaving well together, if they're treating each other well in real life, and if they're listening and negotiating the rules, and if someone happens to get hurt, if they show real empathy and concern, that's what's important, not the idea that they have.
And the last part of each chapter is, try this, add to your toolbox.
Well, it's one thing to be theoretical about this, but really, kids and parents need actual daily tools to rely on. And so these are just ideas. We all have tools that we draw on, whether it's things that how we were raised as kids or things that we've read or stumbled upon. So here's some additional methods and techniques that are time-tested that parents can use and teachers can use in their classrooms.
Now, there is sort of a hierarchy within the book itself. The first couple of chapters are the most important.
Well, thank you. I think you've hit the nail on the head because it is the first chapters are about giving children playtime, welcoming opportunities for conflict, and really examining how we approach childhood in general. It's the foundation.
And then there's a concern about what kids can do and can't do.
Yes.
You give them a lot of leeway, but there are certain things they cannot do.
Yes. Sometimes the concept of free play makes free unstructured play makes adults nervous because we immediately think the kids will be out of control, you know, and it'll just be mayhem. So when I'm thinking of free play, when it's playtime, the ideas for play should be welcomed and not censored. But there are always limits on behavior, and we need to balance the freedom within play with limits as well. And without, you can't have one without the other. Some people naturally err on the side of one. Some people naturally err on the side of the other. But limits, for me, the limit comes down to if a child is playing and they're not hurting people, they're not hurting property, then it's okay.
And as soon as they cross that line.
Right. And you know, if they're hurting somebody's feelings, hurting somebody's body, endangering the lamp or the cat, you know, then you need to put a limit on it. But if it's just an imaginary problem, somebody, you know, as we were talking about shooting the gun with a stick, that's not a real problem. That's an imaginary play one. So that would be okay.
You spend some time on saying sorry, and why saying sorry is a fairly useless behavior, although it sounds polite at the moment, perhaps.
Yeah, well, parents certainly feel a pressure to get their children to be perfect in their manners and to treat people very politely. And those are good goals that we want to raise a child who will be polite and respect other people. But it's hard to force remorse. So saying sorry is one of the ones that doesn't really compute for a young child. But they do learn. What they do learn is that as soon as they say sorry, it's a magic word that gets them off
free.
The hook. They are home free.
They have just clobbered someone and they say sorry.
Mm-hmm. So instead, there's things that you can do that are more useful to both parties. And one is for the child who did something wrong, whether it's an accident or not, to take some action. Go get a tissue. Go get an ice pack. Go bring the teddy bear. Do something. That gets them moving into action. They're good at that. Brings them back to the scene so that they can take some responsibility, see what they actually caused, see the child crying, and realize their actions had consequences. But then beyond that, for the child, instead of to say sorry, is to make a meaningful guarantee, to say, I won't push you again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means something. Now the child who got pushed has a degree of safety. They feel safe knowing that. If somebody says sorry, they don't feel safe.
You do so many interesting things. Like when you talk about art, art for so many kids ends up being highly structured and has to be within certain parameters. And you suggest another way.
Yes. You know, I'm glad you brought that up. Very few people have asked me about, I have a section on creativity and taking creative risks, not just like physical risks or other risks in childhood. And what breaks my heart is when you go into many classrooms, preschool or kindergarten classrooms, you see a line of identical artwork on the wall or in the hallway. You know, everybody has the same paper plate with the two eyes glued here and the triangle nose and time after time, that's what art is presented as. But art, especially for young children, is a time of exploration, and creativity could mean that they take the paper plate and they do something entirely different with it. It's fine to introduce the supplies and the ideas, but if a child is going to be creative, they need to feel welcome that their ideas can change. And I prefer not even showing a child a model of what it should be, because that immediately sets a perfection standard they can't meet, and it tells them this is how it should be. As far as creativity, I also love the ideas of taking art outside and making it big. Because 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds, especially if we're talking about active children and some boys, they're not going to want to sit at an indoor table wearing a little smock and doing dainty small finger work. But if you bring the paints outside and let them zoom cars through it, or let them paint a big cardboard box or something outside.
Or paint each other,
as long as the other kid is okay with that. Or paint their own arms. You can always wash out with a hose. It can be messy, but it's outside. So you really expand art for kids who might not be able to sit still at a table.
Well, you talk about your own son who liked to mix different colored paints together, and he always came up with lustrous browns.
Yes.
And usually he would then wear his way right through the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was hard to tell what. It was non-representational art, but he could talk about the process with great joy.
Right. He explained exactly how he mixed each color. And there's not much difference between science and art for young kids. They're experimenting with materials. They're looking at how different materials move and what colors merge together. And so doing a blob of paint in one spot is just fine. They're learning what they're learning. They're doing what they're interested in. And how we react to children's art is interesting, too. We often, if a child shows us a picture, we say, oh, how pretty, I'll put it on the fridge. Well, a lot of children's art is not pretty, and sometimes they don't intend it to be pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a picture of a thunderstorm. It could be something scary. So instead, you might approach it by saying, I see you did a picture. Do you want to tell me about it?
Mm-hmm. So it's sitting with them and hearing about the art.
From their perspective.
And giving them the time to tell you.
Yeah.
One of the topics you cover is swearing, which is always a problem around the house. We try to rear our kids in such a way that they don't swear, although we sometimes can't control our own language completely. And then they go off to school or the neighborhood and they come back with a linguistically extended vocabulary.
They do.
So could you talk about that and maybe even read from the book?
Sure. I have a renegade rule called let your child swear. And, of course, the renegade reason says that most kids love to say banned words. So just that censorship makes them excited and want to say it, especially if you give a good reaction. So let them say the banned words in the bathroom. Give them a place for free expression. And then the illicit thrill diminishes, but they do feel they have a place where they can try out the word.
Mm-hmm.
So just to start a little bit from this chapter, it begins, Jillian was 5 years old. She knew her mother didn't like hearing the word stupid, so she said it. That's not a word we use in our family, her mother said. Jillian looked her mother in the face. Stupid mommy, she replied. So no matter what word is bad in your family, some people ban words like stupid or boring.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would ban words that are curse words. And there's a lot of potty talk at this age because mm-hmm. kids are interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Especially boys.
And it goes on for years, this interest.
Yep.
And really, there's nothing much wrong with it, but adults don't have to hear it. So if a kid wants to talk potty talk and giggle with his brother or his friend, then why not? There's no harm in it, but you can designate a location. You can say those words as much as you want in the backyard. You can say those words as much as you want in the bathroom. Just find a place where they can do it, get it out of their system, let them giggle to their heart's content, and then they learn there's places it's not appropriate to say it.
So how do you think parents, grandparents, your intended audience, I mean, I read this with great interest as a grandparent. I can't remember those struggles anymore as a parent. Do you think that this is the kind of audience you'll have from parents to grandparents to teachers to...
Yes. You know, a lot of grandparents are fascinated by this book, and it really speaks a little bit more to the way that they were brought up, that they brought their kids up. So they have confidence that this type of this philosophy would work. Grandparents are really interested. Parents, of course, are in the everyday moment.
Yes.
And teachers often have constraints that they aren't able to follow their own philosophies as freely as they mm-hmm. want because mm-hmm. they are part of a greater system in school. But I think it ignites conversations that are worth having and may even change some things at the higher levels if enough people are interested.
What were the most challenging topics to write about?
To be honest, the hardest one was the section on social rejection.
Mm-hmm.
Because this book gets into all kinds of dicey topics, ones that most people don't touch with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about 3-year-olds and sex education and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. The social rejection one is one that sends adults into panic. We think about bullying. We think about they're not being kind to each other. We leap into all the moments when we felt personally rejected throughout life and how terrible it felt. So we have sort of panic feelings that are attached to the very idea of rejection. I wanted to get these chapters right because I think the fundamental ideas are important, but they're difficult to explain. Some of the chapters have to do just with not assuming that all children are friends. Just because they're short, they're not all going to like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is okay. There's all kinds of personalities. We do need to be respectful to other people around us, but we don't have to like them. We don't have to, you'll hear a lot of people say, give that truck to your friend. Well, that might be somebody he's never met before,
mm-hmm.
but it confuses the idea of friendship. So that's one idea. But with rejection, A child should have the right to choose their own playmates. That means that they can choose to play all by themselves if they want, and they don't have to accept somebody coming in who wants to play. They should have the right to enjoy the company of one chosen friend at that moment, that they don't have to accept somebody else coming in. And I find that if you address children's fears, though, they are more likely to accept somebody. So, for example, if two girls had a clubhouse made out of blankets and they put a sign up with an adult's help that said, "No boys and no tigers allowed." And then a boy who was dressed up in a tiger suit came by and wanted to play. And they said they were worried that he was going to growl at them. And he said, "I won't growl." And they said, "Okay, you can come in." So then they changed it to say, no growling, was what they were really worried about, was loud noises. So sometimes to get at the root of what someone's afraid of can make it easy for kids to accept each other. But really, rejection is something that happens throughout life. And if you start young realizing that someone might say yes, they might say no, that it can become something that you get used to, is to take a social risk, try it, and if you do get rejected, it's not the end of the world, and you can recover from it.
Now, these ideas came, a lot of these ideas came out of your own preschool education.
They did. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and attended a school there that called the School for Young Children as a 4- and 5-year-old, and my mother still teaches there. And this school was the inspiration for the entire book because they live this philosophy every day, and I interviewed the teachers and observed classrooms in order to create this book.
People are passionate about their child-rearing techniques. Some people are free-range parenters. Some people are very rigid, spare-the-rod, spoil-the-child parenters. How does this book fit? And have you had any feedback from either group?
Well, there are, of course, so many different family cultures and ways of parenting, and there are many, many good ways of raising kids. There's certainly not one good way. What this book does is presents new ideas and tools that are useful to draw on. But if you follow some of these, you might be one of the few in your neighborhood that does, so it can raise some eyebrows there. I have a whole chapter devoted to how to cope with being a renegade parent when no one around you is doing this, because that's how I've been encountering life.
And you sort of explain that with your encounters on playgrounds.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just a matter of, let's say, we believe in taking long turns. If a child is engaged in something, that it's okay if they want to continue playing with what they're playing with.
Or be on a swing for.
Right. Now, when you're in a public setting, some people might like to continue with that rule completely and let the child be on that swing for as long as they want. In a public setting, I'll often set my kids' expectations. We'll arrive at the park and I'll say, "Oh, look, there are a lot of people here today. Looks like it would be a good idea to take short turns on the swing." So that they, by listening to my observation, they start to notice what they wouldn't have noticed before. Oh, there's lots of people here. We need to give everybody some time. But they're making their own judgment on it, because it's to help them develop awareness of other people. You can't force awareness of others, but you can help point it out.
And that's a theme that runs throughout the whole book.
Exactly, with sharing as well, because you know, a mother told me she tried to have her her kids share by telling them when to share. And when you're doing that, it's the parent sharing. It's not the child sharing. As a parent, we want to develop sharing and generosity within our children, so we need to awaken that within them. So for in the sharing example, when the child's all done with the toy, if you simply remind them Jimmy was waiting for it, then they have a chance to feel that rush of good feelings that comes with, oh, and handing over this toy that Jimmy really wanted. That's when they personally experience the rush of good feelings and want to repeat that again and again.
So let's talk about your life as a writer for a few minutes. You're used to being in your office, working at a topic. In the last few weeks, you have done Fox News. You have talked to the people on WJR. You've been here. You've been many other places. How are you adjusting to this new fame?
Well, it is what authors are expected to do these days, is to do a lot of promotion. And it's two separate sets of skills, and it can be challenging, certainly. I found that what's hardest is I think in my ideas come in book length topics. So I think in chapters. I think in books. And when I'm asked to condense all my ideas for this book that I spent, you know, a long time researching and writing into 2.5 minute or 10 second sound bites, that's a challenge. So it does take practice to figure out how to do that, to convey a book length idea into 10 seconds.
And as I asked you a couple of years ago, what's next for Heather Shoemaker?
Well, I have two other books partly in the works. If this book really takes off, I do have a sequel in mind. It would be called It's Okay Not to Kiss Grandma. Forced Affection. Because this book actually had about 100 to 200 pages cut from it at the very end, including 3 full chapters. So I have a lot of the chapters already written. But I also write fiction for middle grade, which is 8 to 12-year-old children, and I have written most of a ghost story. So
good for
stay
you.
Tuned.
Good for you. And listeners can find a lot of information on a very beautiful website.
HeatherShoemaker.com is my website, and thank you, Aaron. There's information about the book, more about the philosophy.
Okay, Heather Shoemaker, it's Okay Not to Share. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Aaron. A pleasure.